The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is the mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, January 6th, 1946, we present the eighth in the distinguished new NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
the future of aviation. The world with wings, an exciting, better world, or a world of fear and distrust? The future of aviation.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington, and in this capital, as in all capitals on the face of the earth, we are looking into the skies for the answers to questions of world peace, world commerce, world travel. Here with me to tell of the hopes for United States air power in the maintenance of peace is General of the Army H.H. Arnold. We are standing by.
Also ready to speak to you, the Chairman of the Aircraft Industries Association of America, Eugene E. Wilson.
This is Robert St. John in New York. When it happened, no one can say. It was sometime between December 17, 1903, and August 6, 1945, between Kitty Hawk and Hiroshima, that aviation took over man's destiny. One man saw that very clearly. He wasn't the first. He simply pointed it out with one clear phrase. Wendell Willkie made it graphic. Wendell Willkie made it understandable.
In a four-engine consolidated bomber, I left Mitchell Field, New York, on August 26, 1942, to see what I could of the world in the war, its battlefronts, its leaders, and its people. Exactly 49 days later, on October 14th, I landed in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I had encircled the world. I had traveled a total of 31,000 miles, which, looked at as a figure, still impresses and bewilders me. For the net impression of my trip was not one of distance from other peoples, but of closeness to them. If I had ever had any doubts that the world has become small and completely interdependent, this trip would have dispelled them altogether.
Perhaps more than anything else, aviation made it one world. War showed us it's a small world. In the peace years to come, we'll see it become even smaller. And here is one reason. These young men are flyers. They might have been shoe clerks or insurance salesmen or taxi drivers or musicians. But war took them and made them flyers.
Oh, man, this sweating it out is rugged.
Why don't you be real quiet and listen to your points grow?
Well, frankly, I can't see why you characters are in such a hassle about getting out. I'm not through flying yet. Not by a long shot.
Oh, he wants more, and I hope I never see another plane. How about you guys?
Are you kidding?
I'll never get enough flying.
When I get home, I'm going to get a crate of my own and go in the air taxi business.
You know, I'd kind of like to be in aviation somewhere, but there were a devil a lot of navigators turned out for this. Too many for them all to find jobs back home.
Well, I might get a little plane of my own. But just for the fun of it.
Fun? He says fun.
You feel that way now, but wait.
You know, though, guys, there's going to be more flying after everything settles down than any of us can imagine, probably.
Yeah, sure, sure. And about four of us, guys, for every job that opens up.
But not all the plans made by war flyers will be dropped or be lost in the shuffle of post-war activity. We know of one group of pilots who planned and are now carrying through. Let's turn back to the spring of 1941. These men are grabbing a little rest. They're busy pilots because they're with General Chenault's Flying Tigers. Lying in their bunks waiting for the Japs to fly over Rangoon, their talk turns to the question of what they'll do after the war.
You know, I think I know what'll be a good business when the war's over.
That's Bob Prescott, a law student from Fort Worth.
Well, What's going to be a good business?
Carrying freight by air.
Yeah, might be something in that.
That is Duke Hedman, a farm boy from South Dakota. Quiet, easygoing.
You know how many times you said air freight ought to be a good business after the war? 100 times. Sure it'll be. But who's going to do anything about it?
Who's going to do anything about it? Well, Bob Prescott did, and Duke Hedman. Today, there is a National Skyway Freight Corporation doing a coast-to-coast business out of Long Beach, California. Robert Prescott, president. Duke Hedman, vice president in charge of operations. It's called the Flying Tiger Line, logically enough, because a majority of its owners and operators were Flying Tigers. Will this be the usual thing for veterans of the air services to create their own jobs? No, probably not the usual thing, but not a rare thing either. Have you heard of the Northern Airlines? Maybe not, but 60 veterans of the Naval Aviation Service hope it will become an actuality soon. Their petition for a hearing is before the Civil Aeronautics Board now. They'd like to operate an air service between Chicago and Duluth. It started in Hawaii. Jack Cavanaugh was a stocky, pink-cheeked fellow, a former insurance adjuster in Chicago.
I was stationed with a Naval Air Patrol Replacement Squadron when I got the idea for an airline, so I talked it over with some of the other officers. We developed a plan of organization and then began to pick the men we felt would be qualified for operational, engineering, and mechanical jobs. Then we all saved our money and pulled it.
Yes, some of the warbirds will be making their own jobs. Many others will be finding jobs in aviation, but some will be staying on at their jobs in uniform.
And here in Washington, one of the questions most often asked is how many men will stay in uniform to man the air forces in the post-war period. And at our National Hour microphone here in Washington is the man who is deeply engaged with the problems of peacetime military aviation. Here is General of the Army H.H. Arnold, Commanding General of the Army Air Forces.
There can be but one major mission for the Air Forces in the future. That mission is to preserve the peace. Air power today is the first priority weapon for world peace and the first weapon for attack. It may be the only weapon employed if we should, unfortunately, have a next war. So air power must be the weapon that protects peaceful peoples from the international thugs. I mean simply that overwhelming air power at the disposal of an international security council will be the best insurance for peace. So the United States must have air power of top quality at all times. The fantastic possibilities of weapons not yet proven, not yet fully developed, may someday change the situation. But until and unless that happens, we must achieve our first quality air power and continue to improve the technique of war in the air. Maintaining this air power is a job that falls into three parts. Part one can be called air power in being. It is the maintenance of a striking air force that any aggressor knows can start operation in minutes and hours instead of months and years if called upon to defend the peace. Such a force will be available with our proposed 70-group program of 3,900 operating planes and 400,000 men, our present minimum estimate for national security. As warfare is conducted now, to be effectively deployed, it must have overseas bases. It must constantly be infused with new weapons and devices and methods. It must always be at the peak of readiness. Part two is the foundation of air power. It includes constant, driving research that must never lag. The air forces will perforce take leading part in supplying the energy and means to keep us always in front in the field of development research. The overall effect of such research upon general aviation, commercial and otherwise, cannot be anything but tremendous. The effectiveness of the Air Force will depend upon an aviation industry that is capable of rapid expansion. The industry must develop experimental models, sharpen the know-how, and preserve the integrity of organizations that are the nucleus of expansion. Part three is the support of air power. The Air Forces must pioneer in the emphasis of the significance of air power so that Americans become more air-minded than any other people in the world. The Air Forces need an air-minded public, not only to support it, but to guide it, also to people it with its sons who seek an honorable career in the service of their country. These things will help the civilian airlines, will make flying safer for the traveling public. The great passenger aircraft used today for intercontinental travel are the results of the need of our air forces for aircraft of monster capacity and long range. The round-the-world routes they follow are blazed by the air forces. The instrument techniques that carry them through night and day, good weather and bad, the scientific aids to navigation, and many other procedures and devices that sustained their flight resulted from the impetus that war gave to our research. The field of development in air travel is practically unlimited, and the byproducts of a peace-preserving Air Force will be greater safety, more comfort, and faster planes for the traveling public.
Thank you, General Arnold.
How long does it take for a man to cross our continent? The American of 100 years ago would have said 8 months. Yes, his ox-drawn covered wagon might have gotten him across in 8 months. That was about scheduled time in 1840. By 1849, a steam vessel around the Horn could get him there in 4.5 months. 11 years later, a train and coach could make it in 24 to 30 days. By 1869, with the first transcontinental train, he might, with luck, go from New York to San Francisco in 7 days. It was not until 1927 that we began to race the sun across the continent. The first coast-to-coast commercial passenger planes between New York and San Francisco settled down to a schedule of 31 hours, 45 minutes. Last year, with priorities or with luck, the trip from New York to Los Angeles could be made in 14 hours and 35 minutes. That was last year. What about this and the next? Well, that is speculation.
This new transport, the Mixmaster, crossed in less than 6 hours, and it's going to be put out as an airliner before long.
Well, they couldn't keep up a schedule like that, not now at least. But there are new Skyliners that have a cruising speed of 300 miles. That means cross-country in maybe 12 hours.
More important to those who are watching the growth of air travel are the number of passengers and the number of passenger miles. Here's how the past record would look on the graph. 1931 for a starting point.
470,000 passengers, 106 million passenger miles.
By 1935, the number of passengers had almost doubled.
747,000.
Passenger miles almost trebled.
314 million.
By 1939...
7 times as many passenger miles as 1931.
1941...
14 times as many.
1944, 22 times 1931.
2,264,000,000 passenger miles.
There we come to speculation again.
Well, here in Washington, Bob, quite a few people are willing to go out on a limb. And if you average their predictions, they're still skullbusters.
20 million passengers a year within the next 5 years. Passenger miles, not 2 billion, but 10 billion.
Well, those are the speculative facts you hear. But let it end on this one fact. There are now more than 500 applications for scheduled domestic airline service on file with the Civil Aeronautics Board. 500 possible new air routes.
It's not often mentioned, at least not by the name I give it, but there seems to be a rate war in the making. In bidding for post-war pleasure and business travel, the airlines have picked their rival, have taken aim, and are using rates for ammunition. In an Atlanta travel information booth one day...
Now, what was that train fare to Cincinnati again?
Well, with the regular fare on the lower berth, that's $22.94.
I suppose I couldn't afford to go by plane, could I?
Well, I wouldn't know, lady, but I'll look up the rate for you.
Will you please? To Cincinnati, that is, you know.
Yeah. It's $20.70.
Well, $20. I thought so. I just asked... $20? Well, that's less than by train.
There may be uneasiness in some railroad and airline circles over the rate war. There probably is. Everyone remembers the bus railroad battle. That was long drawn out and costly. But most observers look on this present battle as a post-war shaking down to prepare both airlines and railroads for more efficient future service. But another battle also looms ahead, one that involves international problems. A man waiting in a New York hotel last month, bags packed, got the first taste of it.
Hello?
Mr. Burton?
Yes, speaking.
I'm calling from Pan American Airways. You have reservations for the flight to London today?
Yes, I have.
Well, I'm sorry to have to tell you that the flight's been canceled.
Oh.
That was all. No explanation. Not at the moment. Another phone call came later that night.
That flight has been rescheduled, Mr. Burton.
Yeah?
But only as far as Shannon.
Shannon? That's Ireland. But I want to get to London.
Well, we're awfully sorry, but this situation arises from government restrictions cutting flight schedules.
But can I get from Shannon to London?
Well, we can give you no assurance of onward transportation from Ireland.
Oh.
In Washington, we heard an explanation of this through the State Department. The statement came from Great Britain.
Temporarily, Great Britain must set a quota on the number of passengers that will be permitted to be flown from America to our country by United States Airlines. For the present, the quota will be set at 500 passengers per week.
It wasn't necessary to look far for the reason. Britain's BOAC airline was charging well over $600 for a transatlantic flight. Our airlines were selling tickets New York to London for $75 less than the British were. And then suddenly, Pan American's president, Juan Trippe, cut the rate for his line way down to $275, down to about one-third the British line's rate. And how did Britain reply? Pan American was told it could make only two flights a week to the British Isles, while the British said that Pan American's chief American competitor, American Overseas Airlines, which had not cut its rate, could fly seven planes a week into England.
And the upshot of that conflict was that the International Air Transport Association, composed of the companies which fly the international air routes, fixed a new rate of $375 New York to London. Not as much of a cut as Pan American had wanted to put into effect, but still much, much lower a rate than any American company had been charging, and just about one-half what the British BOAC line was charging. Yes, and Pan American was allowed to resume seven flights a week at this compromise rate.
That's the situation at the moment, all right. But International Air Transport Association is holding a meeting here in New York City on Tuesday, and one of its most important subjects of discussion will be rates. Meanwhile, American Overseas Airlines C.R. Smith has predicted that because of economies in operation, it will be possible within 1 year to cut the rate New York to London to $325.
And with that controversy far from a final settlement, there are predictions here in Washington that another international rate squabble is in the making with France.
This also came after a Pan American rate announcement. Pan Am announced that it would soon begin flights to France at a rate of $275.
The figure is much too low, and though I must say this unofficially, I doubt that France will permit it.
What probably is of prime importance to most people today when aviation is the topic is the personal plane, the family air buggy. For almost a decade, flying for everyone has been a tempting dream. The idea is especially appealing today when inviting pictures leap out of magazines at readers. Take, for example, this recent advertisement. There's a picture of an airfield and a small trim plane in the foreground. There's a couple dressed in ordinary street clothes. The man addresses another fellow in a leather flying jacket.
You flew a plane like this in the field artillery, didn't you, Bill?
You bet. It was a plane we all flew. It did miracles. Come on, hop in.
Won't Mother and Dad be surprised to see us?
In the next picture, the couple is in the air with the leather-jacketed fellow at the stick.
This is a super cruiser model, isn't it, Bill? It's so good-looking.
Inside and out, sis. It's safe and easy to fly, and it costs very little to operate.
And here we see the small plane landing on a field. Not an airfield, just a pasture. There's a barn and a silo in the background.
This is the way to travel. There's the folks' farm already, Bill.
Oh, and there's Mother and Dad.
Now the final drawing. The fellow in the flying jacket puts his arms around an elderly woman and man.
Oh, you save a lot of time flying, son.
And we'll see more of you now, Mother.
You know what, son?
No, what, Dad?
I'm getting one of these planes for the farm. Why, it'll pay for itself in no time.
Yeah. It's a good idea.
There's a savory dish to set before an air-minded United States. And today, manufacturers of personal planes enter 1946 with a huge backlog of cash plane orders. Those orders are on hand from people who must know full well that as pilots, they must fly frequently to avoid the risks of going stale at the controls.
And here in Washington, perhaps more than in the rest of the country, we are aware of what will be required of government if the United States takes to the air as we expect. In the Senate of the United States, October 26, 1945,
an act to provide federal aid for the development, construction, improvement,
and repair of public airports in the United States and for other purposes. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled. Title 1, Federal Aid for Public Airports. Section 3, A. The administrator is hereby authorized and directed to prepare and revise annually a national plan for the development of public airports in the United States, including the...
There's not much point in hearing the entire bill, not at the moment. It is being discussed in a joint House-Senate committee, Senator McCarran heading the Senate group, and Representative Clarence Lee, the House. There is a deadlock, principally over whether the airport program should be administered by the federal government or by individual states through their aviation departments. Both sides are agreed, however, that the United States needs 3,000 additional airports as soon as possible, and the program may be allotted $700 million. Another feature of the aviation development that is being watched here in Washington is the aircraft building industry. Some consider it the most important factor in the peacetime employment picture.
If we are to have full employment, there must be new industries, expanded fields of employment.
With 3,000 new airfields, there will be some new jobs open.
Aeronautical inspectors.
Radio operators.
Dispatchers.
Mechanics.
Traffic control personnel.
Stock storeroom handlers.
Stewards and hostesses.
Passenger agents.
Weather observers.
Flight navigators.
Pilots.
Restaurant help.
Reservation clerks.
There are jobs there, yes.
The aircraft manufacturing industry doesn't have quite as rosy an employment future as its recent past. Let's see if we can show its records in a sound grab. There we are, 1939, the war in Europe, a possibility, if not entirely expected.
64,000 employees in aircraft manufacturing.
Then Germany started its march across Europe, up to the English Channel. In 1941, war for the United States. Defeats through the islands of the Pacific. Then the road back through Europe, back along the islands. Victory in Europe. Employment in aircraft manufacture is now more than 1 million. Then, when a bomb hit Hiroshima...
Total employees in aircraft manufacture, 1,237,000.
VJ Day. Since the middle of August, employment in aircraft manufacturing has dropped steadily, steeply, to a figure of just about 250,000. The aircraft manufacturing industry today has shrunk from its wartime position as largest in the world to a position of 15th or 16th in the United States.
And on our National Hour microphone in Chicago is the man who can tell most accurately of the feelings of the aircraft manufacturer, of his hopes and plans for the future. I expected him down in Washington today, but he has just flown out to Chicago. He is Mr. Eugene E. Wilson, Chairman of the Aircraft Industries Association of America. Mr. Wilson.
The explosion of the atomic bomb obscured many developments of great portent. Among these is the fact that the airplane has emerged from the Second World War more a vehicle of peace and commerce and less a weapon of war. Not since the invention of the wheel gave men land transport and the advent of ocean-going vessels gave them marine transport has anything so revolutionary been produced as air transport. Air transport is today on a sound economic basis. The revenue from the sale of airmail stamps so far exceeds the payments to the airlines for carrying the mail that all of our government's direct investment has now been repaid, and the post office is receiving a handsome profit from airmail. 2 decades have given us a self-sustaining enterprise, a source of new wealth and new jobs for many. And we're but upon the threshold of air transport development of far-reaching importance. And, too, new science and new technologies find their applications in the air. Even the atomic bomb is but an instrument of air power and not a substitute for it. Radar promises us early all-weather operation. Jet propulsion forecasts higher speeds at even lower cost. Our future is limited only by our courage and enterprise in science and technology. And this is of far-reaching importance to world peace. Today, the world is beset with suspicions and misunderstandings which can only be resolved by intercourse and trade. Secretary Burns' flight to Moscow in return forecast the early exchange of many more ambassadors of goodwill. Only air transport provides the speed, the flexibility, and economy essential to break down the artificial barriers to peace. We in aviation see the dawn of a new era in the air age, the era of peace through air power.
Well.
The future of aviation has been our subject, and this is what we learned.
We have learned that the private plane will be a popular means of travel in the next few years. There are quite a few wartime airmen, though, who say that they don't care if they ever see a plane again. Our military forces in the air expect to maintain adequate strength to help keep the peace. And in the field of air transport, we shall probably see a struggle for flying routes all over the world, which will be featured by lower rates for travel than we have yet known. The air industry looks forward to this interchange of commerce and peoples, believing that it will help to break down the barriers between nations.
On the subject of aviation, then, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen to the National Hour next Sunday, when our subject will be the Organization of the United Nations.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York, Washington, and Chicago, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the eighth of the new series on current affairs and national problems. Our speakers today were General H.H. Arnold and Mr. Eugene E. Wilson. Robert St. John was your moderator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.